Lost Horizon by James Hilton. Geoffrey Matthews reads the 6th of 10 episodes.
Time seemed to have lost much of its urgency and dominion in this remote lamazerie of Shangri-La. Cut off from the outside world, men lived whole decades heedless of the turmoils of the world at large, and gathered their news only when it had become history and was enshrined in print on fine paper between cloth covers. This timelessness suited Conway, Miss Brinklow, and the American Barnard, but it irked Mallinson dreadfully and drove him to make mischief between his companions. He discovered that Barnard was really Chalmers Bryant, a large-scale financial swindler on the run from the police. Confronted by Mallinson, Barnard coolly laid his cards on the table and admitted that he was Bryant. Miss Brinklow looked up from her book.
"I'm sure I don't care who you are, Mr. Barnard, though I must say I guessed all along that you were travelling incognito. I remember when Mr. Conway said we should all have our names in the papers, you said it wouldn't affect you. I thought then that Barnard probably wasn't your real name."
"Ah, you're a cute detective, ma'am, and, well, I'm not sorry you boys have found me out. So long as none of you had an inkling, we could all have managed. But considering how we're fixed, well, it wouldn't have seemed very neighborly to go on deceiving you. I admit I've left a pretty financial tangle behind me, and that if the cops ever do catch up with me, I'd have one deuce of a lot to answer for."
"You know," said Conway, "it's curious when you come to think about it. Out of four people picked up by chance and kidnapped 1,000 miles, three are able to find some consolation in the business. You want a rest cure and hiding place. Miss Brinklow feels a call to evangelize."
"Who's the third person you're counting?" said Mallinson. "Not me, I hope."
"No. No, I was including myself," said Conway. "And my own reason is perhaps the simplest of all. I just rather like being here." Indeed, a short time later, when he took what had come to be his usual solitary evening stroll along the terrace or beside the lotus pool, he felt an extraordinary sense of physical and mental peace. It was perfectly true. He just rather liked being at Shangri-La. For a moment his mind went back to the world they had left behind them, a world of diplomatic juggling, of international tensions, of fear and intolerance, a world split by differing ideologies and permanently trembling on the brink of self-destruction. But here, at Shangri-La, all was in deep calm. In a moonless sky the stars were lit to the full, and a pale blue sheen lay upon the tops of the soaring mountains. Conway admitted to himself then that if by some change of plan the porters from the outside world were to arrive immediately, he would not be completely overjoyed. Suddenly, in the midst of his reflections, he was aware of a figure leaving the lamazerie and coming towards him. It was Chan. There was an odd air of suppressed excitement about him.
"Mr. Conway, I am proud to be the bearer of important news."
So the porters had come before their time, thought Conway. But he was wrong.
"My dear sir, I congratulate you. You are about to receive a signal honor, one that is extraordinary and unprecedented."
"Well, what's happened, Chan? What is this all about?"
"My dear Mr. Conway, I cannot stress your good fortune too strongly. Come, sir, follow me. You are summoned to meet the master of us all, the High Lama of Shangri-La."
Conway's eagerness grew in intensity as he accompanied Chang across the empty courtyards. They passed through rooms he'd never seen before, all of them rather dim and lovely in lantern light. Then they climbed a spiral staircase. The most striking thing about this part of the lamazerie was the dry, tingling warmth, as though all the windows were tightly closed and the central heating plant was working at full pressure. At last, Chang paused before a door.
"The High Lama will see you alone," he said.
He opened the door for Conway to enter and closed it silently behind him. Conway stood hesitant, breathing the sultry atmosphere and accustoming his eyes to the gloom. Then he suddenly built up an impression of a dark-curtained, low-roofed apartment simply furnished with tables and chairs. On one of these chairs sat a small, pale, wrinkled old man in Chinese dress.
"You are Mr. Conway?"
said the High Lama.
"Please sit down and have no fear. I am an old man and can do nobody any harm."
"I feel it an honor to be received by you."
"I thank you, my dear Conway. I shall call you that according to your English fashion. It is a moment of great pleasure for me. My sight is poor, but believe me, I am able to see you in my mind as well as with my eyes. I trust that you have been comfortable at Shangri-La since your arrival?"
"Extremely so."
"I am glad. Chang has done his best for you, no doubt. He tells me you have been asking many questions about our community and its affairs."
"I am certainly interested in them."
"Then, if you can spare me a little time, I shall be pleased to give you a brief account of our foundation."
"There is nothing that I should appreciate more."
"That is what I had thought and hoped. I wish you now to listen to a story. The story of Shangri-La. In the year 1719, my dear Conway, four friars set out on a journey of discovery into the heart of Asia, and their mission was to establish if any traces survived of the Christian communities that existed in Asia in the Middle Ages. And they travelled for many months, facing hardships which you may well imagine. Three died on the way before the fourth stumbled onto the track that leads into this valley. And here, to his joy and surprise, he found a friendly and prosperous population which showed him the utmost hospitality. He began to preach. The people were Buddhists, but willing to hear him. There was an ancient lamasserie existing then on this same mountain shelf, but it was in a state of decay, so the friar conceived the idea of setting up on this magnificent site a Christian monastery. And under his supervision, the old buildings were repaired and largely reconstructed. And he himself began to live here in these buildings of Shangri-La when he was 53 years of age, in the year 1734. Now, let me tell you about this man. His name was Perrault, a Luxembourger by birth. He had studied at Paris and other universities, and he was something of a scholar. He was fond of music and the arts, and he had a special aptitude for languages. He was born in 1681. When he was a young man, Marlborough had fought his campaigns in Europe. And as the years passed, the folk of the valley and the monks grew to obey him, and in time they came to venerate him also. And so he grew old, very old. And finally, in the year 1789, news descended to the valley that Father Perrault was dying at last. He lay in this room, my dear Conway, where he could see from the window. He gathered his friends and his servants around him and bade them all farewell. Then he asked to be left alone for a while. It was during such a solitude, with his body sinking and his mind lifted to beatitude, that he had hoped to give up his soul. But it did not happen so. He lay for many weeks without speech or movement, and then he began to recover. He was 108. In the fourth year of the 19th century, a second stranger from Europe arrived in the valley. He was a young Austrian named Henschel, who had soldiered against Napoleon in Italy, and a strong friendship developed between him and Perrault. Henschel began our collections of Chinese art, as well as our library. He made a remarkable journey to Pekin, and brought back the first consignment in the year 1809. As you may have discovered, the valley is rich in gold. There was never any difficulty in obtaining things from the outside world. Oh, yes, Shangri-La owes quite as much to Henschel as to Perrault, its founder. His loss would have been altogether irreparable had he not completed more than a lifetime's work before he died.
Conway looked up to echo rather than question these final words. He died?
Yes. Yes, it was very sudden. It was in the of your Indian mutiny. Just before his death, the Chinese artist sketched him. I can show you that sketch now. It's in this room. Look.
The High Lama drew aside a curtain. The features were of great beauty, but the face was that of a young man. You said this was done just before his death?
Yes. It is a very good likeness.
And Henschel came here, told me, in 1803, more than half a century before, when he was already a grown man.
Yes, my dear Conway. What is it you want to say to me?
What can you guess after this long story of mine? Conway's brain swam as he sought to answer the question. He had listened to the narrative with an intentness that had shielded him from its full implication. Now, he was flooded with amazement. "It seems impossible," he said. "Incredible. And yet not absolutely beyond my powers of belief."
"What is it, my son? What is it that you believe?"
"I believe that you are still alive, Father Perrault."
That was episode 6 of Lost Horizon by James Hilton. It was read by Jeffrey Matthews.